I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, the Senate last night approved a $350 billion tax cut plan that includes at least part of the dividend tax cut requested by the president. The Senate bill must now be reconciled with similar legislation passed by the House. But if approved, the tax cuts will reduce dividend taxes by half this year, then eliminate them all together for the next 3 years. After 3 years, the dividend tax will return in full unless further legislation is passed. Last night's bill comes in addition to personal income tax cuts that have already passed but have yet to take effect. Theoretically, the tax cut plan will help revive a stagnant economy, but much of the plan will not come into effect for several years. In the meantime, we're asking, what will the tax cuts mean for you? John Spooner is an author and money manager. His latest book is Do You Want to Make Money or Do You Want to Fool Around? He joins us now. Hello, John.
Glad to be here, Bill.
Well, John, there are two main parts to the tax cut plan, a reduction in income tax rates, and now the temporary elimination of the dividend tax. Let's start with the income tax. When do these cuts come into effect? It confuses me.
Well, they're phased in, and it goes down in stages, and then in 2010, it's eliminated completely, and then it's completely restored in 2011, so that it's almost irrelevant in the sense that I don't know how much good or how much savings we're going to get from an income tax reduction. I think the real key to this program is the dividend relief, and that's where people can really feel it in their pocketbooks, I think.
Well, tell me about that dividend tax cut, and please start with a simple question. What is a dividend?
A dividend is what corporations can pay to their stockholders out of profits as a reward for you investing in their company.
So if you're not a stockholder, this is irrelevant to you?
You're not a stockholder. It's irrelevant. However, virtually every American who works now has a 401k plan, a retirement plan, so that the fire people and the police and plumbers and carpenters and everyone who works for a living in the United States, and more people own stock through these retirement plans than ever before in history.
Aren't 401ks already tax exempt?
Aha, yes. But what people don't understand is the following. If we get dividend tax relief, retired people, and the population of retired people is gigantic, and they've seen their incomes go down for about 12 to 15 years almost annually, meaning because interest rates are so low. You used to be able to buy treasury bonds, say 15, 18 years ago, and get 15%. Now, five-year treasuries are not even 2.5%. So retired people are really hurting, and people about to retire. The benefit for those people is that you own, everybody who has a 401k invests in mutual funds. So the mutual funds that own dividend payers in their portfolios will attract billions of new dollars and go up in value.
But the idea then is that if corporations have more money, they will reinvest it, and it will all flow through the economy and raise all boats, as we
Correct.
Have heard in the past. Why should we trust that?
Well, because more money in your pocket just plain old works. And as you, if you drive,
but we're not talking about more money in the pockets of individuals. We're talking about more money for corporations to invest, and
well,
depending on them to then stimulate the larger economy.
Well, you see, one thing leads to another, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
So that if corporations are doing better because they have an incentive to raise the dividends to their stockholders, it can raise the both perceived and real wealth to the people out there in stockland, mainly through retirement plans.
John Spooner, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
John Spooner is a money manager and author. His most recent book is Do You Want to Make Money or Would You Rather Fool Around?
The World Health Organization announced today that leaky sewage pipes and ventilation fans carried contaminated droplets containing the SARS virus, leading to one of the worst outbreaks of SARS at a Hong Kong apartment complex.
More than 300 people contracted SARS at the building back in March, and 35 of them died. The report named as a cause an unlucky combination of circumstances: a patient with diarrhea, those leaky pipes, and drafty air shafts.
It's just an accumulation of events, said Dr. Heinz Feldman. He says there's no way to guarantee against a repeat, but that another such outbreak seems unlikely.
Meantime, in China, the mainland is taking increasingly severe measures to ensure that the virus is contained.
A woman has received a one-year sentence for her role in a protest against the government's quarantine efforts, and two school principals in the Northeast were fired for holding entrance exams in defiance of orders to postpone them.
And yesterday, Robin, government officials said they may execute people who knowingly spread the illness. Now Chinese officials are turning their attention to foreign adoption. While they have not banned adoptions outright, Chinese officials say they will temporarily stop sending essential documents to people who have already started the process of adopting a Chinese baby. That means some families will now be unable to travel to the region, even though an infant is waiting for them. Other families will have to wait indefinitely before being assigned a child. Well, joining us to discuss that situation is Greg Librand of Texas. Welcome, Greg.
Hello, Bill.
Well, Greg, tell us about your situation. You're in the process of adopting a child, yes?
Yes, we are almost at the end of the process of adopting our child. We actually have received our referral and our travel approvals, and we were ready to go to China when 1 week before we were scheduled to leave, we were told we couldn't go.
And what were the reasons given?
In our particular case, the reason was that the province that our daughter is living in now is closed due to the SARS virus. They're attempting to, you know, cut down on the interprovincial travel. So they told us that we can't come in there right now.
Do you think this is a reasonable decision on the part of the Chinese?
Yeah, I think they're doing what they need to do to stop what could be a horrible epidemic across the world. I think they're going through heroic measures, both the government and the people, to isolate and eliminate this disease.
What kind of a toll is this taking on you and your wife emotionally, though?
My wife and I both and my two boys were extremely crushed when we found out we couldn't go. And, of course, now we're just waiting in complete limbo. We don't know if we're going to be waiting a few more weeks, a few more months, or quite even horribly, possibly more years.
Wow. How old is the child in China?
The daughter that we're adopting is 20 months right now.
20 months. Geez, Greg, do you think people interested in adopting in China may be thinking twice at this point?
Well, certainly people at the beginning of the process shouldn't delay because they've got a long paperwork process to do with the Americans getting approval on our part before they can ever start working with the Chinese. And surely by that time, SARS is going to be cleared up.
Yeah. How long was your process to reach this point now?
We started our paperwork in December of 2001.
Were you and your wife concerned at all about going to a place with SARS?
Slightly. We were slightly concerned. We were going to take extra measures, you know, frequent hand washing. We actually bought a lot of the hand sanitizer to take with us. We had actually cut down on the amount of touring we were going to do in Beijing before they closed that.
So your advice to anyone thinking of adopting at this point from China?
I would continue with the process. It's going to clear up and it's going to open and it will eventually happen. I wish I could tell you when, and I wish it were tomorrow.
Greg Librand, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time, and we want to wish you all the best.
Well, thank you, Bill. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
We spoke to Greg Librand from Grapevine, Texas. He's trying to adopt a 20-month-old Chinese girl.
Well, the SARS outbreak is also having an effect on planning for the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing. Peter Wanikat is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us from the Chinese capital. Peter, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, the Games are, what, 5 years away, but we hear they're already having delays and postponements. What are they?
Yes, the Beijing Olympic Committee announced yesterday, Thursday, our time, that they were postponing a marketing campaign as well as a number of other events and importantly, some event construction. So the marketing campaign right now is something that a lot of people had their eyes on because it was going to be sort of a coming out party for Chinese companies as well as a showcase for multinationals that were looking to advertise and expand their presence in China.
Mm. What does that do financially to those companies?
Well, if it's delayed a few months, probably not a big impact. If it's delayed another 6 months, 7 months, they could see some pain. Kodak, for instance, has been trying to ramp up its film sales in China, its camera sales, and it was hoping that the marketing campaign and being associated with the Olympics would really help that.
Mm. And you mentioned the delay in some construction. What kind?
When you have travel restrictions imposed upon a country like China's had recently, it's really hard for people to get together and discuss projects, to put forward tenders. So, for instance, Beijing wants to build Olympic-quality swimming facility, and one of the places they've been looking is companies in Barcelona. But the Spanish Foreign Ministry, like many other governments, has temporarily urged people not to travel to China.
Well, China was tremendously proud when they were awarded the Games. Can you tell us a little bit about how that pride might have been wounded, not just because of the cancellations that we're hearing about now, but the original cover-up of the outbreak?
You're right. China was riding a wave up to only a few months ago. They had not only received the right to host the 2008 Olympics, which was a very big deal for the Chinese, but also they were admitted to the World Trade Organization, becoming part of the global community. And now Chinese and Beijing people in particular are seeing borders closed to them. Countries don't want Chinese to travel there, so it's almost a pariah status. Mm-hmm. And that has to hurt a lot of people.
Peter, it is still very early on. As we said, the Games aren't until 2008. But is there any talk about the possibility of them being canceled and going to the next country in line?
No, there's no talk like that right now. I mean, I think you're right to raise the five-year issue. I mean, look where China was 5 years ago, 1998. More than a few analysts thought that the economy was on the verge of collapse with the Asia financial crisis. And then in the years following, China recorded some of the strongest growth in the world. So I think it's much too early to write off China, and I think the government would feel the same way.
Peter, one last personal question, and briefly if you can. What precautions are you taking, if any, against SARS?
Well, the Wall Street Journal has some pretty strict safety protocols. We're not supposed to interview doctors that have been in touch with SARS patients face-to-face. We're supposed to wear masks when we go into crowded places and avoid hospitals. Of course, all of these precautions are good, but it's rather inhibiting when you're a reporter used to moving around the country fairly freely. So it takes some getting used to.
Well, Peter, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks very much for having me.
Peter Wanicott, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Beijing.
Just ahead, photojournalist Steve McCurry talks about his famous photo of a green-eyed Afghan refugee girl and his new collection, South, Southeast.
And later, our editorial roundtable on lies, plagiarism, and race following the Jason Blair scandal at the Paper of Record.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WVUR, Boston's NPR news station. Taiwan expects a long battle against SARS as health officials warn of another possible wave of infections. For more on that story, go to our website, wbur.org, and click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs. One location, nine galleries, 6,000 rugs, featuring choices of hand-woven rugs from around the world. Gregorians, a little part of Persia in Newton Lower Falls. By the Huntington Theater Company, presenting Springtime for Henry, a classic comedy playing now through June 15th, huntingtontheater.org. And by the Lenox Hotel in Boston's Back Bay, recipient of AAA's Four Diamond Award and the American Hotel Association's Environmental Hotel of the Year Award 2000. In the forecast, mostly cloudy skies, maybe a peek at the sun, highs 55 today. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a little light drizzle, lows 42. Tomorrow, morning clouds should give way to a partly sunny afternoon in the 50s, and Sunday looks like a very nice one. Sunny and mild, might get up to 70 degrees. Right now, though, 50 and mostly cloudy in Boston. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's here and now.
Think of the iconic photographs. Nick Ut's picture of the naked napalmed girl in Vietnam, Dorothea Lange's Dust Bowl migrant mother, or Steve McCurry's Afghan girl.
I think Geographic describes it as one of their most recognized images.
No, it is the most famous picture of the National Geographic without any question.
Steve McCurry's green-eyed Afghan girl first stared at us from the cover of National Geographic in 1985 and became a symbol of refugees around the world. But Steve has taken hundreds of photographs, winning photojournalism's highest awards. He has a new book out called South Southeast, and recently he came to Boston University to speak about his craft at the invitation of the American Society of Media Photographers. We spoke to him during his visit, and you can follow along by looking at the pictures on our website, here-now.org. How often do you think about her, the Afghan girl?
The subject of Ashar Barkul, the Afghan girl, literally comes up every day. I get emails every day from people that either want to communicate with her or use her picture for publications, textbooks, advertising. So there's a continual correspondence about this one photograph.
Yeah. And then some people might be aware that with National Geographic, you went and they ultimately found this now woman.
Right.
In this first picture, the one you took that's so well known, she looks terrified, almost wild-eyed, and yet open. Mm-hmm. You know, like a bring it on world, almost. But in the second picture, she looks so much more closed.
Mm-hmm. That's true. In the first picture, she had never had her picture taken in her life. And this was the first time she had met a foreigner, first time she was photographed. So I think there was a surprise, this curiosity. I think, you know, 17 years later, she's more familiar with the ways of the world and not really being... Culturally, it's not acceptable to be photographed, although she agreed to be photographed. I think there's this a little bit of anxiety and a little bit of, anxiety that maybe this isn't, you know, I shouldn't be doing this. Mm. Now, we had permission from her husband and, of course, from her, but even so, I think there's a little bit of a questioning, a little bit of a, you know, she doesn't seem to be so easy with having her photograph taken the second time.
So interesting, because you've said, you've been quoted often as saying that what you try to do is wait for your subject's soul to reveal itself. The photograph really is what we will get to know of her.
That's exactly right. When I kind of walk down the street, kind of move through life, and I look at people who strike me in a particular way, I guess I'm just looking for some kind of emotion that I can identify with, that I can relate to. And I say, oh, that person, there's a sense, that person has a sense of fear, courage, or beauty, or something. And there's some chord, some kind of a, I don't know, deep chord that's struck inside me, which I kind of somehow, I think, you know, this somehow is a very special person.
Well, I've got in my lap your new collection of your best photography. You traveled through India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, Tibet, Thailand, Cambodia, and Burma. Can we look through?
Sure.
And I just want you to stop me on a picture where some of the things we've been talking about are illustrated.
Well, this picture, it's of a child sleeping. You know, the parent is a book vendor on the street of Rangoon. These are the kind of pictures which I kind of live for as I kind of walk around the streets of, you know, New York or Bombay or Hong Kong or Rangoon in this case. It's just a little vignette, it's a little private moment of somebody, there's some passersby walking in the background, and I just thought this is really interesting, all these books and this little kid asleep.
Here's one from Calcutta, India. Mm-hmm. Why don't you describe it?
This is a couple street dwellers, and the woman's making lunch literally right there on the street. It's just the most amazing thing. I mean, I grew up in a house with a yard and big kitchen, eating kitchen, and here this woman has literally just put a couple of bricks together, made a fire, and is making her lunch.
Where was that you grew up?
In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. What took you, what's the lure for you?
I guess I'm restless. I love to travel, and I love to go to new places. And I think once you get that in your blood, it has sort of taken over my whole life. And I spend probably 9 months of the year on the road now.
So you will go to great ends to get your photographs. So you can maybe help those of us. I know I have this problem, and maybe a lot of our listeners do. Sometimes I care too much about getting the photo. It hurts my heart. It's like if I can't get that, capture that thing, and take it home with me. Do you have that, or are you somehow able to? You're shaking your head.
If I see something really important, like September 11th or whatever, I just try and get into a zone where mechanically I just go through the motions of making pictures, whether it's operating the camera, framing. I missed the first tower going
right.
down because I never dreamed. Who would ever dream that the tower was going to collapse? But actually, once the first tower went down and the smoke cleared and it wasn't there, it was. I knew that, I'd better be ready for the second tower to go down. Mm. As it was disintegrating, I was wondering, in this camera with 36 exposures, what frame am I on? Am I at the end of the roll? Am I going to miss this because I'm going to run out of film? And I just pressed the shutter. So you just have to let your sort of subconscious take over, I suppose.
One last question for you, Steve. I'm going to go back to the young girl from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. I was trying to think how many people are so closely identified with an image of one person.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's the photograph from Vietnam with a little girl running down the
right.
road after the napalm bombing. And there are a few others, but not that many.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself thinking that as well? I mean, you are one of them now.
Yeah. No, it's in a way, I feel a little bit detached from the picture. I mean, it's been so long ago. But it's a great honor to have a picture which has become iconic. If people remember me for that one picture, so be it. I'm happy.
I think your follow-up on the Afghan women was so touching.
Photographer Steve McCurry. His new collection of photographs are in the book South, Southeast. And don't forget to see some of his pictures, including the green-eyed Afghan girl. Go to our website, here-now.org.
Next week on Here and Now, the recent suicide attacks in Chechnya and Russia's response. Will offers of amnesty to Chechens who lay down their arms end the violence?
There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by PIMSLR Direct Language Programs, featuring over 35 languages. 35% of each purchase goes to help pay for the news on WBUR, available at the public radio store at WBUR.org. Caritas St. Elizabeth Medical Center, an academic affiliate of Tufts Medical School and members of Caritas Christi Healthcare. Information on their physicians and programs. Programs available at semc.org. And Bistro 5 in West Medford Square, highlighted in the current Zagat survey titled Spotlight on America's Top Restaurants. Menus at bistro5.com. That's bistro, the numeral 5.com. For a limited time, you can enter a drawing to win the latest model from Subaru, a new Baja, courtesy of Cityside Subaru in Arlington. See the new Baja and enter the drawing with your contribution for the news online at WBUR.org. Something new is coming to WBUR this June. It's the first annual WBUR online auction, and you can help make it a success. If you have an item or service you would like to donate to the auction, please let us know. We'll thank you by providing your company or organization with exposure on the air and on our website. To make a donation, call 800-909-9287 or log on to WBUR.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, did affirmative action fail or did the New York Times fail in administering it? The fallout from the Jason Blair scandal at the New York Times.
And a review of the hottest of sequels, The Matrix Reloaded, where Neo, Morpheus, Trinity, and Agent Smith are back. In fact, the Smiths are multiplied.
You.
Yes, me.
Me, me, me. Me too.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Iran is denying U.S. claims that it is sheltering members of the al-Qaeda terror network. A spokesman for the Iranian Foreign Ministry says his government does not support terrorism and makes its policy clear. U.S. officials have said they believe at least three al-Qaeda leaders are in Iraq, including Osama bin Laden's son. The Saudis are expressing regret for the terror attacks that killed 34 people, including eight Americans.
We are sorry for not having been able to win this battle in the war against terrorism. We are determined that we will prevail in the war against terrorism.
Adel Hubayr is the foreign policy advisor to Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah. The human rights group Amnesty International says it's investigating claims that British and American soldiers tortured Iraqi prisoners of war. 20 former prisoners of war allege they were kicked and beaten by soldiers during interrogation. There's been no comment yet from the Pentagon, but the British Ministry of Defense denies the claims. President Bush may be welcoming the Senate's passage of a $350 billion tax cut plan, but the White House says it's still not big enough. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says the president will push for a larger tax cut when the House-Senate Conference Committee takes up rival measures next week. The House has approved a $550 billion tax cut plan, which is also less than the president wanted. Either way, Democrats say the Bush plan is a gift to the rich that will boost the deficit more than the economy. And it's official, President Bush is running for re-election. The White House filed formal papers today with the Federal Election Commission, paving the way for Bush to seek a second term. This allows the president to raise money, hire staff, and open a campaign headquarters.
We'll go on down to Jackson. Go ahead and wreck your hell.
A public funeral will be held Sunday for country singer June Carter Cash. A spokesman says her death is a terrible blow to Johnny Cash, the country legend who was married to her for 35 years. Carter Cash died yesterday of complications from heart surgery. She was 73. Consumer prices fell in April, the biggest decline in 18 months, led by a retreat in energy prices, sparking fears of deflation. And on Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 44 points at 86.68. The Nasdaq is off 12 at 15.39, and the S&P is off 5 points at 9.42. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Innuendo, offering decorating solutions to help meet their clients' needs, featuring shutters in wood or thermalite and silk or sheer panels from around the world. The Newman School, a small co-ed college prep school in the Back Bay, application still being accepted for fall 2003, on the web at newmanboston.org. And by the Elephant Walk Restaurant in Porter Square, featuring their innovative menu of Cambodian and French cuisine, ample complimentary parking available, menus and reservations at elephantwalk.com. In sports, the Red Sox take on the Texas Rangers for the last in their three-game series at Fenway Park tonight. Pedro Martinez takes the mound for Boston. And a weather forecast looks like it'll be cloudy in the 50s today. Sky should be brightening as we go through the weekend with a very nice day on Sunday. Temperatures in the mid-60s to about 70. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The New York Times calls it a huge black eye. Conservative pundits point to it as proof that affirmative action doesn't work and the liberal media lies. An African-American colleague of mine said that when she first heard about it, she silently prayed, "Oh God, please don't let him be black." But he is. And 27-year-old Jason Blair is also an incredible liar, fabricating and plagiarizing dozens of items and stories for both the New York Times and the Boston Globe over the course of 4 years. Blair began his career at the Times in an affirmative action program, and his actions have newsrooms across the country talking about fact-checking and diversity programs, so we're going to as well. Joining us on the line are Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Robin.
Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Randy.
Hello, Robin.
And we welcome a special guest, Candace Presley. She's president of the National Association of Black Journalists. Hi, Candace.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, let's start with you. Is this story of Jason Blair about race?
No, it's not about race, although all this week everyone has attempted to make it about race. What the story is really about was an inability of the management at the New York Times staff to manage who we thought was going to be a star candidate, star reporter at the newspaper, The young man was just managed ineffectively. He was moved from department to department when he didn't work out, and he had more cheerleaders rather than coaches.
But Candace, you know, some would say it's only because of his ethnicity that they were doing that, because they wanted to have a young black person succeed.
No, I disagree with that very strongly. What happened was, yes, the New York Times is working very hard, and I applaud their efforts to increase the diversity of voices at their newspaper reporting the news. Yes, they have an internship program where they look for quality minority talent. Paper also has a very strong initiative to bring young people into their ranks. Mm. There were just, again, I strongly argue, a number of internal systems that should be applied not only to the Jason Blairs of the world, but all employees who are going to hire into the New York Times that simply were not followed.
Well, you know, let's bring in Randy and Flagstaff and Guy up in New Hampshire. I mean, New York Times executive editor Howell Raines said to his staff on Wednesday that as a white Southerner, he probably did give Jason Blair extra chances. Your take, Guy.
Well, I'm awfully uncomfortable about this from my perch up here in New Hampshire. I think if this fellow had worked for me, I would have tried to keep him, too. Robin, you said he was an incredible liar. I think he was a very credible liar for a while.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. He's also a good writer. And so you see somebody there with some talent, with potential you don't know.
And by the way, Guy, up in New Hampshire, how many minorities do you have working at the paper?
We have, over the 25 years that I've been here, we have had only one black person,
right.
And she lasted about 6 months and went on to a much bigger newspaper.
Right.
This is a buyer's market, and we do make efforts. It's difficult.
Yeah, Randy, I'm asking you in Flagstaff, Arizona, the same thing. I mean, how much would your paper try to keep a minority, and why would you do that?
Well, we try to make them succeed, but I think in this case, they really didn't have the training and the mentoring in place, as well as the accountability mechanisms to catch someone with such a history of serial lying. It just is almost beyond belief reading that four-page account in the Times.
Right.
But I think we ought to say that human beings and human enterprises are fallible, and I don't think we ought to get quite as worked up over it as the country has, probably because it's a media story over the last few weeks.
Well, but some people would say that it's more, that it's a cultural story. And Candace, I'm wondering, Brian McGorry, writing in the Boston Globe, points out that Mike Barnicle, writing for the Globe, was also first just reprimanded by the Globe, and then 5 years later they had to fire him as well, and that at the time Howell Raines wrote that he was a product of a male-dominated, mostly white tribal culture that takes care of its own. Is it possible that that concept has now been applied to affirmative action? It's the same thing.
Well, no, not exactly. And I think one thing that has been lost in the debate, at the end of the day, we're all going to find that the beneficiaries are largely white and are largely female. But because in this example we have an opportunity to put a black face on the subject, it all of a sudden becomes a black thing when it really should not be. Again, the bottom line is the good thing about diversity initiatives, especially newsroom diversity initiatives, when they work right, you have, one, the right talent, you have, two, the right coaching, and then, three, you get the right kind of feedback. And unfortunately, in this situation, those things were missing in this New York Times situation.
Yeah.
The toughest column that I've seen on this, by the way, is by Cokie and Steve Roberts. I don't know if you saw it, but they compared the Times behavior to the Catholic Church protecting pedophile priests.
Wow.
Moving them from parish to parish. It's pretty
I think
pretty
that's
rough.
A bit much. I don't think the New York Times, for all of its sloppiness, had any idea how egregious these things were that this guy was doing.
And if they didn't, Candace, is there any solace in the fact that maybe this means that a young black has made it into a good old boy network, which, I mean, who doesn't know the white manager who's been promoted up, the brother-in-law?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's that.
And that's exactly what it is. See, what he had was he schmoozed his way into the network where the good old boys who've assimilated in are just the good old boys who were there, and he was a pet project.
Well, it just seems like, boy, there's a lot of chatter on talk radio about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know. But Guy and Randy, let's talk a little bit about the other aspect of the story, which is fact-checking. A lot of people were surprised to hear that reporters get to check their own facts at the Times and that they can have a source and not name it. Your thoughts on that, Guy?
Well, here at our little newspaper, we have to share our sources with the top editors, but I don't necessarily think that source checking is at the heart of this. If somebody is going to lie, if somebody's going to make something up, I mean, remember Stephen Glass at the New Republic.
A white
man, so we didn't have this big conversation about, is this a white issue? Are these white people going to be, you know, what's going on with them in the
with
newsroom?
With these whites who are reporters.
Yeah, white people in the newsroom, what's happening? But in any event, with the Stephen Glass case, he was making up, you know, infinitely more in the sense that he was making up institutions, people, situations.
Events.
And then he would, and they would make up websites that the fact checkers could check, proving that his events were all true. I mean, if you're willing to go to extremes, you can cheat.
Yeah.
What seems so strange, Guy, at least to me, is that so few of his sources actually complained, or at least if they did, the complaints weren't heard. And that really brings up the question of how accessible are these top editors and how willing are they to listen to their lower sub-editors.
Yeah, the both of you are absolutely right. There were certainly a number of disconnects on the newspaper's part. Mm-hmm. That is very troubling to me as a journalist, as it should be troubling to all of us.
One danger, too, Condis, the profession has been able to monitor itself, but as you get these kinds of assaults on its credibility, you may find outside institutions like prosecutors come in and actually try to intervene in that process.
Yeah. Well, one last thought. We may get to hear more about this because apparently Jason Blair is fielding offers to tell his story. And we're going to let conservative columnist William Safire from The Times have the last word. I mean, he is uber conservative, and he slaps back his friends on the right by saying the New York Times does not lean left. He's never seen it, and that he thinks there should be more affirmative action with, in fact, more Hispanics and Asians helped to come up faster. And don't throw away the system, just fix it. So we'll leave it at that, but we know it won't be left at that. There'll be probably many more conversations. Thanks for having this one with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
Condis Presley, president of the National Association of Black Journalists, Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona, and Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire, members of our editorial roundtable.
Well, still to come, our film reviewers choose The Red Pill and dive deeper down the rabbit hole for a look at The Matrix Reloaded.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The sequel to the 1999 film The Matrix opens in theaters around the country this weekend. The movie imagines a world where human brains are fused to machines in a sinister plot to fuel an alien society. But right here in the real world, scientists are using technology in ways which, well, can seem like something out of a movie, fusing machine to animal, though for less sinister purposes. To find out about one project, we're joined now on the line by Professor Miguel Nicolelis, who's a neuroscientist from Duke University. Welcome, Professor.
Oh, hi.
Well, Professor, tell me about your project.
Well, we are studying possibilities of linking brain signals with artificial devices in order to use these devices to mimic motor intentions that animals have when they are solving a particular behavior task. Of course, the goal of this, as you said, is much less sinister. What we hope to do is develop a technology that could one day help paralyzed patients to actually enact their voluntary movements using robotic devices. So since they cannot move themselves, perhaps we could use the brain activity that they produce when they think about moving to use this activity to control robots, like a robotic arm, that can be used to enact the movements that they want to produce.
Now, what kind of animals have you been working with?
Well, we started a long time ago with rats, and we evolved to primates.
Monkeys,
yes.
And what have you been able to accomplish so far?
Our latest result shows that not only the monkey can learn to control a robotic arm while we seize on a monitor the performance of the arm, but he basically learns that when he has to achieve a task with the robotic arm, he doesn't need to move his own arm. So it's almost like the monkey imagines the movement he wants to perform. He is able to control this movement in a robotic arm, and he doesn't move his own arm. So it's almost like the animal incorporates that robotic arm as if it were his own arm.
So the monkey, and perhaps potentially a human, thinks about moving this robotic arm and then somehow sends, what, an electrical signal that enables that arm to be moved?
Exactly. These are electrical signals that come from the brain. They are transformed in real time by a mathematical model, and the output of this model goes to a robot. And all the main parameters to move the robotic arm are, you know, extracted from this raw electrical activity that the brain produces.
Now, how far are we from being able to translate all this for humans?
Oh, I feel that in a couple years, assuming that we demonstrate all the, you know, the safety and, you know, a few more developments of this technology, that we could start thinking about transferring this technology to the clinical arena.
And again, it would be most valuable to which people?
Well, patients that have severe degrees of body paralysis, patients with, you know, spinal cord injuries, degenerative disorders that render them severely paralyzed, and patients that cannot communicate with the external world. So there are many potential clinical applications.
Fascinating, and let's hope it works.
Thank you. We hope so.
Thank you. Professor Miguel Nicolelis, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Professor Miguel Nicolelis is a neuroscientist from Duke University.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sudbury Granite and Marble, direct importer and fabricator of granite and marble services for homes in Boston, the Cape, and the Islands, in Sudbury, Mendon, and West Hartford, Connecticut. By David L. Babson and Company, investment advisors to private clients and institutions, working to help clients build and preserve wealth since 1940. David L. Babson in Cambridge and on the web at dlbabson.com. By Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for graduation celebrations at 617-720-5511 or online at lalaroqh.com. For a limited time, you can enter our drawing to win the latest model from Subaru, the new Baja, courtesy of Cityside Subaru in Arlington. See the new Baja and enter the drawing with your contribution for the news online at wbur.org. 50 degrees, mostly cloudy now in Boston. News from the BBC is coming up at 1 o'clock. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
When The Matrix came out 4 years ago, it was a tech noir sci-fi surprise hit. The story was wildly original, surprisingly philosophical, and just plain fun, with gripping, gravity-defying fight scenes. The Matrix tells the tale of an apocalyptic battle between man and machine, a battle the machines eventually dominate, hooking themselves up to human bodies for their energy. Some humans escape, digging deep into the earth. The rest exist in a virtual dream world, controlled by artificial intelligence. That's The Matrix. The Matrix, for many, became an instant classic. And now the creators of the film, the Wachowski brothers' ardently awaited sequel, The Matrix Reloaded, is here. Keanu Reeves is back as Neo, and Lawrence Fishburne returns as Morpheus. The story picks up as thousands of machines known as Sentinels or Squiddies attempt to reach Zion, the underground city, to destroy what remains of the free human race.
A sentinel for every man, woman, and child in Zion.
That sounds exactly like the thinking of a machine to me.
Morpheus, glad you could join us.
Niobe. My apologies to all, but as you are undoubtedly aware, it has become increasingly difficult to locate a secure broadcast position.
Squiddy's got all our best spots.
Mainline is crawling with them.
And if Niobe's right, in 72 hours, it's going to be a quarter million more.
What are we going to do about it?
We're going to do what Commander Locke ordered us to do. We'll evacuate broadcast level and return to Zion.
And does the Commander have a plan for stopping 250,000 Sentinels?
Of course, if you're not familiar with The Matrix, that scene made absolutely no sense. But Here and Now's film reviewers Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham have seen both the first and second of the trilogy and are here to talk about The Matrix Reloaded. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Our guest reviewer this week is Brandeis University professor William Flesch. He's seen just about every science fiction film ever made and focuses on a few of them in his upcoming book, Vicarious Experience. Thanks for coming in, Professor.
It's a pleasure.
Well, Professor, briefly explain how The Matrix and The Matrix Reloaded fit into your work.
I'm interested in what the experience of fictions is like, why we get gripped and worried about things that aren't real. And one of the ways that literary works explore this, or that science fiction explores this, is through virtual reality. The Matrix movies are great meditations on virtual reality and fiction.
Well, you said the Matrix movies. How does Matrix Reloaded compare to the original?
I think it's not as good as the original. It's gripping to watch. The philosophical issues that it brings up, it does in a more half-hearted way and in ways that seem less consistent and less thought through. Although, to do them credit, I think they're trying very hard to get other philosophical issues into Matrix Reloaded than what they were looking at in the Matrix, in particular questions of causality and levels of reality.
Wow, that's the amazing thing about these films, that you can use words like that in talking about them. Renee, the plots, though, notoriously complex. Can you at least kind of set the scene for how this film unfolds? I know Morpheus, Trinity, and Neo are back to save the world from the machines.
Right. They've returned on the Nebuchadnezzar, and they're heading back to Zion. Zion is the last outpost of humanity, uncontrolled by the Matrix.
Roger that, Control. Zion Control, stand by for gate 3 lockdown.
Neo, who's played by Keanu Reeves, is the former computer hacker, and now he's coming into his own as humanity's deliverer, who's going to deliver them from the tyranny of machines. When they return to Zion, there's this threat from these sentinels, which are, they look like huge squids, so I sort of thought of them as, you know, angry, uncooked calamari. And it's up to Morpheus and Neo and Trinity to find a way to destroy these machines and save Zion.
Zion. Eric, tell me about Zion. What is that all about? What does it look like?
Zion is the human hangout. Have you ever been to Mammoth Caverns, Bill?
No, but I've seen the bumper stickers
all right,
on an
well,
awful lot of cars.
It's a lot like that. It's basically a big cave. You know, they're sort of near the core of the Earth. And, you know, for people who've seen the original film Metropolis, kind of the granddaddy of all sci-fi films from 1926, Zion looks a lot like the sort of sub-levels of the underground city in that film.
Professor, you were alluding to some of the themes here and using intriguing words like causality and that sort of thing. Elaborate.
Well, the question about the reality of the external world in philosophy and in these movies is often a question about whether the mind can change anything by doing something. In a virtual reality, in a world that's constructed by computers, it would feel like the computer was setting everything up and therefore no one could do anything that wasn't already in the program. A video game would work the same way. In the first Matrix, it seems to turn out that that's not true. In the second, the repeated information that characters are given is that they don't have any choices to make, that the choices are already made.
And what we're getting here, I think, from William is that you basically need to see this movie twice in order to get any kind
maybe
of
understanding. Maybe three times, maybe four.
Maybe so. I mean, the film is incredibly complex, and they've sort of backloaded it all into the last 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, so it's really difficult to kind of get through that. Until that point, we've got these dazzling visual moments. A lot of people who've seen the first one will, of course, remember Agent Smith, played by Hugo Weaving, and he's back this time again, but he's multiplied. He's now sort of a free agent, unconnected to the Matrix, and he is able to duplicate himself.
You.
Yes, me.
Me, me, me. Me too.
But that's the whole thing of The Matrix. It's this action film that has all these big intellectual ideas. I'm not sure they can pull them all off because it gets awfully confusing. And since there's not a lot of backstory, so if you haven't seen the original, it's like, you know, waking up underwater blindfolded. You will have no idea what's going on.
And that's in some ways kind of the problem with criticizing this film is that it depends entirely on the first movie. This movie not only depends on the first one, but it also depends on the second one.
It was going to be the third one, yes.
Which we haven't seen yet.
It's like reading the middle chapters of a book.
Although I have a prediction about the third one. I agree that it depends on the third one. I think that it's going to turn out that Zion is also, within virtual reality, is also in a Matrix. There are very heavy hints of that.
I think the virtual reality works. There's a lot of sort of virtual acting in this movie.
There sure is.
Lawrence Fishburne, who plays Morpheus, was really loose. He had this sort of jazzy feel to him in the first movie. Now he's performing Othello again.
Yeah,
Shakespeare
he's James Earl Jones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's just big and everything's very grand. And the dialogue is a bit nonsensical, and he tries to imbue it with such power and strength. It's a little laughable at times.
Today, let us send a message to that army. Tonight, let us shake this cave. Tonight, let us tremble these halls of earth, steel, and stone. make them remember. This is Zion, and we are not afraid!
Of course, Keanu Reeves is, well, Keanu Reeves. And,
whoa.
Right. He's fine for what he is, but now that he's more into the Neo persona, he's not just this hacker figuring out what his destiny is. He's much more serious and therefore much more wooden and a lot more blank.
Although they do have a little bit of fun, I think, with Keanu Reeves' screen image. There are a few lines that sort of refer to his sort of lack of personality, which at least the Wachowski brothers are able to have some fun with that.
And, he is the one.
Yes, and evidently Reeves is too.
Well, the $64,000 question, are they getting away with it? Industry analysts are predicting that this will be the biggest opening for an R-rated movie ever. Did you guys like it, Renee?
It's not as good as the first. There's no way of getting around that. But as Eric said, it's hard to judge it without seeing this next segment.
Eric?
You know, one of the interesting things about this movie is that there's a good deal more sensuality in this film. We finally get the payoff to the Neo Trinity romance. So in some ways, it's quite a bit different from the first, but it's still that roller coaster you're going to have to ride.
Professor Flesh?
It's not as good as the first, but it's still a really wonderful movie. It's utterly gripping to watch. You'll want to see it several times just to see some of the special effects. And it'll make you want to see the third. You can't not see the third now.
They've got us hooked.
They do indeed. Not as good as the first, but still awfully good. Everybody seems to agree that it's a pretty dazzling film. Thanks to all of you for coming in today.
Thanks, Bill.
We've been talking, of course, about The Matrix Reloaded. Our guest reviewer this week was Brandeis University professor William Flesh. He's the author of the upcoming book, Vicarious Experience. Renee Graham is pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Eric Schaefer is a film historian who teaches at Emerson College.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.